It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guest today is Jen Ashoff, a geology professor at UAA who recently became the 10th person and the second woman to complete the Chugach 120. The Chugach 120 is the 120 peaks in the Chugach State Park with a prominence of 500 feet or more. Unlike the Chugach Link Up, which links all Front Range 12 peaks over 5,000 feet in one go, the Chugach 120 can only be achieved over a period of years. It entails some relatively easy walk-up summits, but also some technical climbs, including rock and ice climbing, with long approaches that may include glacier travel. Jen looks at the Chugach 120 as a personal challenge that anyone who likes to hike can work up to. She will share how to get started and connected to the Peak Bagger community. Keep listening for more on Outdoor Explorer. This is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guest today is Jen Ashoff. This summer, Jen became the second woman to finish the Chugach 120, summiting all 120 true peaks in the Chugach range. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer, Jen.
Thanks, Lisa. It's nice to be here.
So first of all, tell the audience just a little bit about yourself. You're kind of growing up what you did and getting to Alaska, or maybe you've already been in Alaska for a while and in your introduction to the mountains.
Oh, it's been a long, strange trip.
Oh, perfect. I like those trips.
I grew up in Maine and I went to college in Montana and college in New Mexico and spent a little bit of time in Texas going to school. And so I've now lived in 8 states, getting various degrees and then just following different opportunities. And I came to Alaska when the University of Alaska at Anchorage was hiring for a geology professor and they offered me the job. So I came here and I've been in Alaska, which is the 8th state that I've lived in since 2014.
Oh, so wow.
Going on 9 years.
So when you were growing up in Maine, I mean, there aren't huge mountains there, but there are mountains to hike, right?
Right. Yeah. So I got into climbing in 1995 and I went to the White Mountains and I took a climbing class while I was in high school and I was hooked, really hooked on it. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to go to Bozeman. And so I moved to Bozeman and my boyfriend at the time was a climbing guide. So we spent all our free time in the mountains. And then as a geology student back then, I spent even more time in the mountains, which was awesome. Being able to blend my passion for the mountains with my profession was a really cool opportunity and one that I don't regret in any way. That's how I got into climbing. I've been doing it for a long time. And you know, for a time there, I did spend a little more of my free time focusing on my profession. But when I came back to Alaska, that's when I really decided, okay, you know, I spent most of my life focusing on my career here. And I think I want to spend a little bit of time on personal goals. And so that's how I came to mountain sports here in Anchorage.
So tell us a little bit about the Chugach 120. When you sent me this email, I was really intrigued because I think it was floating around in the back of my head somewhere, but I had some realization of it, but it's not like as well known as like the Chugach Link Up. And
oh, sure.
Yeah. And then so, which, by the way, you did the Chugach link up, which this summer.
Right. Yeah.
You finished in July?
In July. Yeah.
Before the rain started?
Literally like the day before it started raining.
Oh my gosh. You so lucked out, didn't you?
We did.
So you finished, you did that. And so, you know, obviously we've done a lot of shows about the link up. It's pretty well known and it's super accessible. And it's kind of a more of a competitive, maybe sort of a competitive type adventure, not always, but, you know, everybody seems to be trying to do it the fastest they can, or, like Sophie Tiddler trying to do it, like doing it, not trying to do it, doing it on winter solstice, you know? And I think it's something that women have really picked up. I went back and I looked at the list and saw some more women on that list now, which before it was just kind of dominated by men. And I know that's kind of maybe a passion of yours to get more women into doing these things too. So that's a really long introduction to what is the Chugach 120. Tell us about that.
Well, I guess I'd back up a little bit and just say, like, there's this sub sport called peak bagging, and many mountain runners are really into it, and lots of hikers are into it. And essentially, it's just this, you know, this way of getting into the mountains where your objective is to climb a certain set of peaks. And, you know, the Chugach 120 is an example of a fairly, you know, a fairly adventurous goal. It's 120 true peaks in the Chugach State Park. And the goal is to climb all of those peaks. Many of the peaks are hike ups, and definitely not all of them, but many of them are. So it's a great, it's a great goal for hikers who kind of want to do a little bit more. And it's a great way to force yourself to learn new skills. I feel like the Chugach is one of the best mountaineering classrooms you can get. We have glaciers. We have glaciers in the summer and glaciers in the winter, which are a little different. And we have ice climbing. We have skiing, like phenomenal backcountry skiing. We have hiking and running and technical rock climbing, technical ice climbing. So to climb all these 120 peaks, you really need to be a jack of all trades and be able to do some rock climbing and climbing on really loose rock at times. And you also need to know how to travel glaciers, either on foot or on skis. So it's a cool goal, especially for those of us kind of later in life. Like, I didn't start working on this till I was in my mid-30s. So mid to late 30s even. So it's kind of something that gives us motivation to learn new things. And I'm all about being a student again. As a professor, I feel like it's really useful to be in the shoes of the students to remember how scary it is to learn something new, and just how rewarding it can be when you master something new and something challenging. So I view the Chugach 120 as a pretty hard goal, and one that would like bring you from hiking through mountaineering, learning all the skills that you need to be a pretty proficient mountaineer. So that's kind of like the big goal. But like I said at the beginning, just this concept of peak bagging is really fun. And it's really not competitive, like in contrast to the link up that you mentioned. I've never felt any competition in my community of mountaineers. I always felt supported by all the finishers. There are 9 other finishers, and most of them actually, you know, we shared beta for details on climbs for different peaks. We always shared information about the conditions. Certainly in the interest of safety, it's great to be able to share those details. Whereas like the link up, they're pretty secretive about sharing details about the route. So I think for the 120, it's really not competitive. You don't really get any accolades for finishing them quickly because, in my opinion, it doesn't really make sense to do these quickly because it's really dependent on how much time, free time you have, and like how lucky you are with the conditions and with the weather and with lining up partners. I mean, some of the peaks I soloed, but many of them, if not most of them, I did with friends and partners. And, you know, I also think going after a goal like this, where it's something a little bit new and different, it forces you out of your comfort zone a little bit. So you meet other people and you kind of need other people. And it really makes you feel like you have this community by the end of it, of all these wonderful people. And, you know, like it's been a great experience to climb them all. And people ask me like what I got out of it. And honestly, it was the relationships that I built through the whole process of pursuing these peaks, the deep relationships that I, you know, solidified with my partners. And many of my partners were women, which was cool. And spending time out in the mountains with other women is just priceless. It's really, and I love my male partners as well, but it's pretty cool to find all these women that have a passion for climbing and for peak bagging, for mountain running, and just, you know, building this great community of strong women. And, you know, so far there's only been two women that have finished the Chugach 120. And a good friend of mine, Kathy Still, has been working on this list for quite a while. And she's really close to finishing, so she'll finish soon, which is great. And I saw on Peak Bagger, there's a number of other women. So it's exciting to see that more women are going after this. And I'd like to see even more women get involved in it. It's such a cool goal. So as far as peak bagging goes, you know, if you're a hiker and you just want to have a goal that's not real competitive, it's a personal goal for yourself. I would recommend people go to peakbagger.com and look at some of the lists that exist for the Chugach and start out with just hiking all the front range peaks. All the front range high points. That by itself is a really fun and cool way to get out into the mountains. And it might force you to go and meet some people to have partners to do some of the harder ones. And then from there, you can be, if you feel like being more adventurous, you can try the whole list of the 120 peaks. The 120 peaks are based on all the peaks that, at least back in the early 2000s or late 90s, had 500 feet of prominence or more.
And so that was one of the questions I had for you. Yeah. Is what is considered a true peak?
Yeah.
Because that's part of the terminology of the 120 is all the true peaks.
So my understanding is the list was developed by the Mountaineering Club of Alaska, and they define their true peaks as those that have over 500 feet of prominence. And so this is changing actually because as the glaciers recede and some of the peaks that before did not have the 500 feet of prominence do now.
And so can you explain how that, like, because I was kind of intrigued by this, because one of the things that you mentioned is next year in the link up, Ptarmigan Peak is going to be added because Ptarmigan?
From what I understand, Ptarmigan Peak was added for 2023.
Because now they're recognizing that it's over 5,000 feet.
Right. So I don't know the whole story about that, and I apologize for that. But what I do know is that as our mapping capabilities improve, we can get better details on the elevation of certain peaks. And so part of the issue is that we're realizing that some peaks actually, like a lot of these maps, these lists are based on, are quite old. Some of them dating back to the 20s and 30s even. Mm-hmm. So as we refresh those maps and understand the elevation better, because we have more advanced technology now, then we're realizing that, first of all, some of the peaks we thought were below 5,000 feet actually are over 5,000 feet. But then another layer of complexity is that as the glaciers recede, for prominence, you might have a peak that beforehand didn't have that prominence, but because the glacier's receding and the glacier's essentially going down in elevation, it gives those peaks the bump so that they make it above the 500 foot prominence line. So there's changes happening to these lists, or potentially changes happening to these lists because the prominence changes. I think from what I understand, the Mountaineering Club is not going to change their 120 list. They'll probably keep it like a historical 120 list just for historical purposes. And also just so you're not moving the target all the time for people. Mm-hmm. But that's a discussion the Mountaineering Club can have, and they'll decide what they want to do with all the new data coming in, showing us that we have peaks that are 500 feet of prominence or more. But my understanding for the link up is that they found that Ptarmigan probably is over 5,000 feet and therefore should be included in the Front Range link up.
So I know that this isn't necessarily an answer you might have, but do you have any idea how they're going to do that with the link up? I mean, is there going to be a whole nother set of like records, I guess, the records?
Oh, you know, that's a good question for Joe Stock. I mean, he's sort of the gatekeeper for all that.
I'll ask him. I'll see if I can get an answer before I have to record the close to the story, so we can find out about that.
Absolutely. And the link up it's pretty competitive, so it's a little bit different than what we're talking about here with the peak bagging. And I mean, the peak bagging is just something that average people can go out and do, and you don't have to have any super high level of fitness, just sort of average hikers can go and accumulate all these peaks, which is kind of fun, and circle them on the map and just see the progress you're making on the lists. And the 120 is a pretty cool goal, I think, personal goal that isn't competing with other people, but it's more like, you know, participating in the community and becoming part of the community.
So what is the lowest true peak in the Chugach?
Oh gosh, I didn't know this was gonna come up as a question. I'd have to look at the list.
Because I'm thinking, wow, are they, a true peak thing of 500 feet is like a universal or standard, I guess. So that it's probably above 500, right?
Right, most of the peaks are I would guess all the peaks are probably over 3,000 feet.
Okay.
I don't have that information at the tip of my
head. Yeah, like Flat Top would be one of the peaks, right?
Yes.
So many people have done Flat Top as, you know, recreational things. So you're well on your way. If you've done Flat Top, you've started the journey.
Right. So I'm looking at the list right now, and you can sort it by elevation. So I'll tell you, so the lowest elevation peak is Bird Ridge Point.
Oh.
And that's 3,505 feet. That's the lowest.
Mm-hmm.
And the tallest one is Bashful Peak, which I believe is the tallest in the state park. So, and that's 8,005 feet. And it's a pretty tough one to that one. I would say most of the ones that are over 7,000 feet are pretty tough. The easiest one to go for, in my opinion, that's over 7,000 feet would be Bold Peak. That's a very hikeable peak.
And where is Bold Peak?
Bold Peak is the really obvious one when you go to a Kootenai Lake and you start biking or hiking up the lake trail. You see this big, beautiful peak off on the left-hand side when you're walking up the trail. It typically has a lot of snow on it. That's Bold Peak.
So then the Bold Peak has a long approach to it then, because this is part of it, right? It is part of like peak bagging that, I mean, you can't like have a helicopter go drop you in out there. You have to get yourself in there, right?
It's debatable about whether or not you can use access. I think the American Alpine Club technically allows you to have air support to access the peaks. Mm-hmm. And certainly the Mountaineering Club doesn't have any rules like that. It's these are all just personal goals, really. Mm-hmm. Most of us don't use air support to climb these things just because most of us are kind of purists. But we do use bikes. And so it's kind of fun to, you know, ride your bike out to the base of the trail that goes up to Bold Peak, ride your bike out there and then climb the peak, come down and then ride your bike out.
Oh yeah. That would make a huge difference in the amount of time you have to spend out there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You can do it in a day. It's a big day, but you can do it in a day. Or, you know, like I would also say this about the link up, you can make it as hard or as easy as you want. There's no reason why an average hiker can't just go out and do the link up as an overnight trip or as a multi-day trip. You can make it as hard or as easy as you want. Mm-hmm. You could do every single peak, you know, do a peak a day and take, you know, a little over 13 days to do it, whatever you want to do. Same thing applies to these peaks. You could just ride your bike out with all your camping gear, put those in panniers, spend the night, you know, out near Serenity Hut at one of the campgrounds or at the hut, and then go and climb Bold Peak and come back and have a nice dinner and then ride out and make a really nice weekend of it. Mm-hmm. So there's no time. I mean, there's no time limit on these peaks. You can do them as quickly or as take as much time as you like. That's kind of the cool thing about the peak bagging is it's just up to you.
It's super personal. Yeah, I like
that. It is. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. If you want to see how fast you can do Bold Peak, yeah, go for it.
Yeah. So with Bashful, I think you just said that you felt like Bashful was the toughest one to do. Or was that the tallest one? I can't remember now.
Yeah, Bashful is the tallest. It's 8,000 feet. And I think it's a, you know, it takes a little bit of climbing skill to climb that one. And the conditions really are variable. You probably want to take a rope on that one. And there can be ice in the gully that you have to climb. So you need some ice climbing skill to do it. Other times it's just rock and you need a little bit of rock climbing skill to do it. So I think Bashful is one of the harder ones. If I had to choose like the hardest one, I think I'd probably choose Baleful as the hardest, either that or Polar Bear. Yeah, those two are pretty hard.
So where are those two and what made them hard?
Baleful is hard because it's way out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I remember the approach was close to 25 miles just to get.
Oh, wow. That's a long time.
It's a long way. And so we rode our bikes in to where the East Fork takes off. And then we hiked from there up to the base of Baleful and then in a day. And then we climbed Baleful and came down in a day, camped at this little lake called Blissful Lake. And then we came out. So it took a couple of days. Let's see. I know that's not the only way to go in there, but also that climb had some technical rock, like what I would say was more like 5-6 rock, but good rock. And it's exposed, so it's a bit scary on that one. To me, that's one of the ones you save for when you've built up enough skill that you can go for it. And Billy Finley does a great job of describing a lot of the more technical climbs on his website, AK Mountain, which I gave you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the easier ones certainly are described and have additional information on peakbagger.com. So people, if they're interested in some of the peaks I mentioned, can look them up on Peakbagger and find some information or look them up on Billy's website.
When you were doing this, how many peaks, like what year did you start doing this and how many peaks a year did you do, or did you have a schedule, or did you just kind of, were you kind of halfway, not halfway, but partially into it? And you're like, oh, I'm going to go for this.
Well, I think what happened was I did a couple hikes with my friend, Jennifer DuFord. And, you know, she kind of is the one that opened my eyes to this whole idea of peak bagging. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool. Maybe I'll climb a few of these. And I climbed a few with her and then met some of her friends and then joined the Mountaineering Club and made some partners who, and they sort of introduced me to some of the more difficult peaks. And so initially I was just doing hikes. So if you look at when I first did my first hike in Alaska, I probably started in 2014. And then I really I got more serious probably like in 2016. And at that point, it was like whenever the weather was good and I could find partners, I was pretty much in the mountains every weekend. And then I had a lot of fun coming up with link ups of my own, you know, like how many peaks can I get in 2 days? And I just sit there over coffee in the morning, looking at the map and just thinking, okay, let's see if I can find some cool long traverses or loops where I can pick up maybe 6 peaks at once. And so I have this whole list of different traverses and loops and figure eight loops and lariat loops that I've done with different peaks along the way. And, you know, one of the most fun things was coming up with this idea of a traverse. And then I just draw it out on this kind of janky map and then text it to a couple of girlfriends and see who would bite and who was interested. And then we would go out and we would do it. So that was always fun. So you can sit down with the map and come up with your own link ups, but, you know, completely not competitive at all.
It seems like a lot of the fun of whenever you're traveling or hiking is, and you're trying to decide where to hike, is just looking at maps and kind of, that is like a real piece of the fun. Like, I'm going to figure out how I can do this and where I'm going to go. And then that anticipation of doing it.
Yes, I love maps. And part of my job is teaching students how to use maps and how to use the technology now to do like field work in remote places just for geology. But as a peak bagger, I devour maps. I just love them so much. I can sit for hours and come up with different routes. So you know, Luke Mail has some very, very useful tools and tips and tricks on his website, looking at CalTopo, looking at Gaia GPS. And I know also that some of the avalanche schools like Alaska Guide Collective are starting to teach some basic using like a Gaia GPS for route planning and avalanche terrain and that kind of thing. So certainly there are some great tools available to us, and I just love sitting down with a map and coming up with new ways of doing things or just seeing how many peaks I can get in a trip. It's interesting too. It's like a hypothesis testing because you look at the map and you come up with a route, but the resolution of the imagery you have may not show certain features. And then, so it's a hypothesis, this route is a hypothesis, and you get out there and you realize, oh man, this is like a sheer cliff. That wasn't shown in any of the data. So you have to find a different way around it. So you can spend hours and hours planning out routes, but they still may or may not work until you go out and try them. Mm-hmm. So it's still an adventure.
My dad was a geophysicist. And so wherever we ever went, we were always talking about the geology of where we were. And he would tell us how things were formed and what kind of rock there was. So I don't think I've ever asked anybody, maybe once, but not from a geologist perspective of, can you just tell a little bit about how the Chugach Range was formed and what kind of rocks are there and the famous Chugach crud and all of these little special things about the Chugach Range.
Right. Yeah. So the Chugach Mountains are, you know, they're, most of us that have hiked there realize it's kind of a crumbly rock. And the reason is that they, at one point, they were sediments on the ocean floor. And so they would have been mud and sand interbedded for the most part. That's what we're looking at. And then some places conglomerates. And so there's a natural horizontal layering to those sediments initially. So that's one layer, one plane of weakness, if you think about it like that. And then once those sediments are lithified as rocks, they become sedimentary rocks, and they're layered sandstones, layered shales. And once they're rocks, they were actually uplifted as during the collision, those rocks were uplifted and tilted and deformed in some places. So you have another layer of weakness superimposed on that horizontal layering in the sedimentary rocks, where you have fractures superimposed on that, and you have folded sedimentary rocks. So we may go to places like Crow Pass, for example, where you'll actually see some of the sedimentary rocks standing up vertically. So that's why they're so crumbly. They have multiple layers of weakness superimposed on that one kind of rock unit. And these rocks are Cretaceous in age for the most part. There are places where the rocks are Jurassic. So you're looking at rocks that are, you know, around, you know, 100 to about 68 million years old, just depends on where you go. So that's about the range of the rock. So the short story is they were sediments on the deep ocean floor that were lithified, and then they were uplifted as the plates collided and the Chugach Mountains were uplifted.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. We are going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll hear more from peak bagger Jen Ashoff.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guest is Jen Ashoff, who recently completed the Chugach 120, summiting all 120 peaks over 500 feet in the Chugach State Park. So besides, I have no science background like my dad or my brother, but because the Earth is still active, can they still be pushed up higher from not just from the glaciers receding, but just from plates colliding and earthquakes and things? Can they go higher?
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. And there are many places, a lot of the ranges in Alaska are still moving. And so there are many places where you can put GPS units on the peaks and actually measure in real time the motion of those rocks. So wow. That's not my area of expertise. And so that's about as much as I'll say about that.
That's more than I knew. So,
okay. Yeah. But we can actually measure how much they go up, and they definitely are moving, especially on active margins like Alaska.
Wow. So. That's really crazy to think about that they're still moving around. That time between they were sediment on the floor of the earth, the ocean floor, and the time they became what we know as them now, how many millions of years was that?
Oh gosh, you know, around 70, you know, somewhere between 100 and 68-ish million years ago, depending on which interval of rock you're looking at. So mm-hmm. Yeah, we're looking at, you know, around 100 million years, I'd say.
Yeah. I just love the idea of that change, but also that change takes a long time, but then also that there's change that's happening quickly, which isn't necessarily good because of climate change. But yeah, it's fascinating to think that we're kind of always, our environment's always changing and moving.
Yeah, yeah, it's very interesting. And you have such a wide range of geology and all these peaks in the Chugach too. I mean, it was really exciting for me to spend so much time in the Chugach State Park. If from one area to another, I would see just very different rock types. And even as the glacier recedes, such as like the Akutna Glacier, there's some really interesting rocks that have come out from below the glacier. So there's new outcrops coming out all the time around the glaciers where they're receding. It's, for me, it's really personal to see the glacier recede so quickly. Mm-hmm. It's very personal. When people talk about climate change, I never felt like it was personal until I moved to Alaska and actually got out in the state park and started to experience the landscape in a different way. And now, just over the 8 or so years I've been working on the 120, I've seen so much landscape change, especially with the glaciers. And wow, you know, the climate change feels very personal to me now.
Have you noticed also the vegetation change in that short of a period of time? Because those of us who've, you know, lived here 50 plus years, I mean, definitely you're seeing the march of the alders and the birch up the side of the mountains. And it's pretty crazy how fast it seems like there's the vegetation is going up the mountains.
Yeah. I mean, now that you mention it, yeah, I have noticed that, but it's, I'm so hyper-focused on other things.
Yeah.
I guess I don't pay as much attention to the vegetation, except for when it's scratching me,
yeah,
poking me in the eye.
Well, you've probably also seen the pictures of Portage Lake, because when I was a kid, you know, you could go out there, you could see Portage Glacier, and there were just huge chunks of ice, you know, right up to the, to where the parking lot was. And that's kind of gone now. Can't even see the glacier anymore from the parking lot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. There, and that's another cool thing about going after one of these lists, like the Chugach 120, you get to see places that not many people ever go to or see. A lot of these are off trail. And so you have to know how to navigate a map. And you know, it just brings you to places that most people don't go, and you see these small glaciers that a lot of people never visit. And you get to see those small glaciers, like the Wall Street Glacier, for example. I mean, that's experienced a lot of change. The glacier at the head of Ram Valley has changed a lot. It's essentially a rock glacier now. There's some really interesting places to go that not many people get to see. And you really get to experience the landscape a different way by going after a goal like this.
Oh, well, I think it's also like you've been doing this for 8 years, right? 2014. And you've seen that much change already.
Yeah, especially with the Akutna Glacier.
It's, which is where our water is coming from, right? So that's a little scary.
Yeah, good part of it, definitely. Yeah, it is. That is the one that's been the most impressive to me. Of course, you know, down in, outside of the Chugach, there are really accessible places for people to view that change, like the Exit Glacier. Mm-hmm. But it's happening here in our own backyard. So one more reason why people should get out there and experience more of these deep peaks in the Chugach
before it changes a lot more.
right.
Or I mean, it is a way to kind of witness the change, obviously, like you've said. So so let's go back to Peak Bagger and talk about that. So I do have your, on my other screen over here, I have your page pulled up. And why don't you start by explaining peakbagger.com, how it works, how people read it, and all, I mean, there's a wealth of knowledge on it, obviously.
Right. So I would say that peakbagger.com is a tool for climbers, hikers, and mountaineers. And if you just go to their website, I have nothing to do with the website, by the way. I don't manage it. I don't create it. I don't do anything. Somebody else does that. I'm just a member of it. It doesn't cost anything to use it. You can just go in there and you can make a donation, and the donations are appreciated from what I understand. But if you go to the homepage there, you can look up lists of peaks, and different users create these peak lists. So for example, I believe Steve Grun, who is he used to be a board member for the Mountaineering Club, but I don't think he is anymore. But he's kind of our go-to guy in the Mountaineering Club for official MCA peak lists. So Steve has a couple lists in here that are our official club lists for peaks. And the Chugach State Park 120 is one of those lists. So people could go to that website, they could open it up, and they could find lists for Alaska, lists for the Anchorage area. And I sent you a couple links. So if you want to post that.
Yeah, we'll definitely post those.
Yeah, then people can just click on those links and they can find the information a little easier. So I would recommend that people check out the Front Range list, which is not an MCA list as far as I know. But one of the users created this list of all the Front Range high points. That's a fun one to do. Just so you can go out and hike. They're all hikeable peaks. They're not anything crazy or things that require climbing experience, technical climbing experience. So I would recommend that list. And then the Chugach State Park peaks is a great list. That's one of our official MCA lists. There's a Western Chugach 700 or 7,000 foot peak list, which is kind of a cool one. I haven't finished that one yet. I'm working on it. There's a couple more I need to do. And then there's a list for the whole Western Chugach, which I'm not sure who made this list, but it tells you who made the lists. So you can look at that list as well. So that has the whole Western Chugach. How exactly that one's defined, I'm not sure if it's the traditional Western Chugach. But the nice thing is that the users can go and they can find the lists that interest them. And they can even contact the person that created the list to see what the metrics were for the list. So there's a bunch of lists that are preloaded in there. And I sent you some links for the ones that I'm interested in, that probably your listeners are interested in too. But users can make their own list if they want to, using the metrics on PeakBagger. So they can come up with a list of their own, where maybe they just want to do everything that has over 1,000 feet of prominence, or maybe they want to do all of the peaks, or maybe over 100 feet of prominence. Whatever the metrics are, they can set that up and do a search. And you know, I'm not sure if PeakBagger is updating the data that are used in those searches. For example, I don't know how old the elevation data are. But that's something that they could reach out to the creator of PeakBagger to find out if they wanted to. I mean, certainly you can do these same kind of searches in something like ArcGIS, which is a program that a lot of geoscientists use in different ways. And you can put some of the newest elevation data in there to get the peaks. But for your average person that's just a hiker and they just want to come up with a cool list or a cool goal to go for, this is a great tool. And the data, I think, are probably good enough for the average user to go and come up with a list of peaks that they can aim for.
Well, I like that, because you can just make your own metrics, like, okay, I'm just going to hike everything between 1,000 and 2,000 feet, right? Could you do something like that and just say, okay, that's my goal for this summer, or this week, or whatever?
Yeah. And it's just kind of fun. It gives you some ideas. So for example, you know, you can climb like the Mountaineers Club, all their five peak list. They have five peaks in their mountaineering club. So different mountaineering clubs submit their peak list to this too. They're a global list. So you could, if you want to climb all the seven summits, well, that's a list too. So you can start chipping away at the seven summits if you want to. So there's lots of things, or if you're going to Europe and you're thinking, oh, well, gosh, I wonder what there is to climb, you know, on my European vacation. You can go on Peakbagger and look at some of the lists here to get some ideas of what could be an interesting climb. Also, when you click on some of the peaks here, you can find some trip reports and other information for the different peaks. So
one of the interesting things I saw was someone had created the second highest mountain on the seven continents. List of the second highest. so maybe you're working your way up to that, you know, I don't know. Or you do the first and you're like, oh, might as well do the second. I thought that was kind of interesting. But then you can also, if you want to, you can set up your own page, right?
I'm not sure.
Do you join it somehow? Because there's a peak bagging page for Jen Ashoff.
Oh yeah, that's for me to keep track of all my peaks. And then there is a way that folks can reach out to different climbers. So if you find a list that you're interested in, say in Anchorage, and you can see who else is working on it, and you can actually reach out to them through email and find them.
I saw that mutual. There's some sort of mutual list. I thought this was really interesting because what I'm looking at right now is the quick top 10 list peaks on your page.
Okay.
And then there's a priority, and I don't know what that means. A priority column.
Oh yeah. So the priority just means like which list is my priority right now? What am I working on? What's most important to me?
And so that's just a personal thing that you rank yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there's the percent that you've done of that list.
Yes.
Yeah. That's really cool. I like that.
Yeah. And you can look at the highest peaks you've climbed. You know, so if you want to climb some high peaks, you know, some that are, you know, 20,000 footers.
And I'm going to point out that you have some very high peaks on this list.
I have a couple. Yeah.
You're being so modest. I think Denali's on this list.
Yeah, Denali. Yeah.
Yeah. Denali.
I highly recommend it.
We tried to
climb Mount Foraker this summer, but we failed. But everyone else failed too, so we don't feel so bad.
But it looks like you have quite a few in Ecuador and Peru.
Oh, those are great ones. Yeah, I had a lot of fun down there. So you can look at, if you're going to South America, you can look at some of the peaks that would be fun and interesting to climb.
Mm-hmm. Let's see what other interesting. Oh, I think there was a how many days with ascent. How many days in the year? Is that what that means? That you've had an ascent?
It must be. I don't know. I've never looked at that before, to be honest.
Does 117 sound about right?
Oh gosh, yeah, I guess so. That's in total, I guess.
In total, that's how I'm reading it. It says overall statistics and ranks. So this is really cool because it was like how many days with a sense. You had 117. And then even though this is non-competitive, it also has how you rank among it appears to be maybe everybody on Peakbagger. Because there's maybe like 22,000 people on Peakbagger and you rank 743. So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. That's pretty funny. Thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah. Yeah, I did a little bit of a deep dive here. So
that's cool. I think your listeners will really get a kick out of this. And if there are any listeners that just aren't really into competitions, like, you know, mountain running competitions and such, this is such a fun thing for just average hikers to do.
Mm-hmm. So if you really wanted to make this whole 120 your goal for, you know, some period in your life or just your life, there are though some skills that you need in some of these harder peaks. And I am assuming like the Mountaineering Club of Alaska is a really good resource to learn these skills. Like, how do you learn to ice climb? How do you learn, you know, to rock climb in these skills that you might need to get some of these peaks?
Oh, that's, yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. So the Mountaineering Club has their annual ice climbing festival that's coming up very soon. And I believe that registration just opened, and Jamie Mack organizes that through the Mountaineering Club. And she, you know, she's a volunteer and has been doing it for years. So if folks want to learn how to ice climb, that's a great place to learn. And it's really affordable. I don't know what they're charging this year, but membership with MCA is only $20. And you have access to a lot of these different events. So they go out to the Mac Glacier, and they, you know, they're all different groups, from, you know, experienced climbers doing the advanced skills class to absolute beginners that have never even put crampons on. So that's a great way just to get out there, meet other members at your level, and learn some skills. So that one goes on every year. And then we've been trying to do a glacier travel and crevasse rescue class every year, although COVID kind of messed up our scheduling. But I co-teach that with Garrett Verbeek and Nathan Pooler and a few other folks, Andy. That's a great class that usually comes up in December. So if people have a little bit of climbing experience, they probably get a little more out of that class. So they might do like the ice climbing and then go out to the glacier travel and rescue class. And that's a really good set of skills right there. Plus you meet some experienced climbers, and MCA has a mentorship program that they can get involved in, where experienced climbers mentor some other members. So I think the Mountaineering Club is like the most affordable way for folks to get into it. And it just makes it accessible to everyone, because I hire a guide or a guide service every year or every other year to sharpen my skills in some area of mountaineering, either like technical climbing or some rescue skills or avalanche training. I do that, but it's expensive and not everyone can afford that. So the nice thing about the Mountaineering Club is that pretty much anyone can go in there and meet the right people and learn some of the skills they need and network so that they can find some mentors to get through the process.
And I think you've said this earlier, like one of the most fulfilling parts of this whole journey was the people that you did it with.
Yeah, I didn't expect that. I when I got into it, it was all about, I need to be in the mountains and this is great. But it ended up being this thing where when I stand on any summit in the Chugach now, I look out into the landscape and I see these peaks and I remember just the fun, crazy experiences I've had with these amazing people. And I mean, some of my partners, like Kate Fitzgerald and Sophie Tidler and, you know, Ed Smith and Jennifer DeFord. I mean, there's like so many amazing people that I've spent time with in the mountains. And I just love that I can look at these peaks and have such a deep connection to them through the people. Mm-hmm. So it was just really unexpected. It was more just like a mountain climbing goal and turned out to be a community that I ended up with that I didn't expect to have. So
I think, and I don't know, you've had more experience in other communities too, but is there something special about the Alaskan community too? Because there's just, it's so accessible, but then it's just so, it seems to be so much part of our culture as well.
It's, I haven't been involved with any other communities. I was so focused on my career that I didn't do any of this stuff really until I moved to Alaska. But yeah, I feel like Alaskans are so different and they're very They're very generous with their knowledge and with their sharing their skill sets. They are very passionate about being out in the mountains and protecting their resources. And I just think overall people have been really welcoming and generous and supportive of pretty much everything in the mountains in this community.
And do you think that, or I shouldn't say, are there efforts to have, or are there classes for women only that the Mountaineering Club does, or are all the classes mixed gender? I mean, I know men are very important to this too, obviously, but there is something about the bond that women have together in nature as well.
Yeah, as far as I know, the Mountaineering Club doesn't have any all women's classes, but there's an organization called She Jumps that does do all women's classes, and perhaps some of the guiding services are offering that kind of thing now. I'm not sure. Definitely on a national level, there are lots of all women's classes to get into. Mm-hmm. But I would say our mountaineering classes are about 50-50.
Oh, so that's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. And it's a great way like to meet other women getting into it. And other women at your level, it's really fun to find somebody that's at your level that doesn't know the same things that you don't know. And then you kind of go through the adventure together, picking up skills along the way, supporting each other, making mistakes, hopefully nothing major, you know, and so you can find people to go through the process with. And there's just something about spending time in the mountains with other people that really solidifies the bonds that we have. Mm-hmm.
Well, Jen, it has been really great talking to you. I'm so glad you reached out to me because this has been a great conversation and I've learned a bunch of stuff. I hadn't really, you know, like I said, the Chugach 120 wasn't on my radar too much, a little bit, but it's just really fascinating to hear about it and dive into peak baggers and hopefully expose a whole lot of people to this, men and women that have another goal they can go out there and shoot for.
Yeah,
so thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to share this with your listeners.
That's it for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Jen Ashoff. You can find pictures of Jen and links to the Mountaineering Club of Alaska and Peak Baggers, including the list of peaks worldwide and the list of the Chugach 120, on the Outdoor Explorer page at alaskapublic.org. The show was produced by Eric Bork. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.